I will call the meeting of the March 4th, 2025 meeting of the Public House Safety Committee to order. A quorum is present. If we don't complete our work today by 4:45, we will take a brief recess and reconvene in this room at 5 p.m. Before beginning our meeting, I want to remind everyone that the committee expects proper decorum at all time. All dialogue goes through the chair. Signs are not allowed in the committee room. There will be no outburst or clapping. There's no standing or sitting in the alleys. If an accommodation is needed, communicate with sergeant staff. There will be consequences if there is a disruption. Thank you to the sergeant arm staff who are present for helping maintain decorum in the committee room. Representative Hollins, have you had a chance to review the minutes of the February 26, 2025 meeting?
Mr. Chair, I've had a chance to review the minutes, and more importantly, I've had several very competent staff members review the minutes, and I move their approval.
Representative Hollins moves the approval of the February 26, 2025 minutes. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries. And the minutes of the February 26, 2025 meeting are approved. The first bill on the agenda today is House File 135. Representative Myers, I see her at the table. Could you have your testifiers come up with you?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Representative Myers, since you are not a member of the committee, I will remove your bill before the committee. Since the fiscal note came back with a small cost, we will be laying your bill over for a possible inclusion in a committee omnibus. Representative Myers, I see you have a technical amendment coded A1. I will move your amendment before the committee. Please begin your please explain your amendment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. It's just a technical amendment. What it does, it just deletes state prisons so that it'll cover our local jails.
Does anyone have any questions about the amendment? All in favor of adopting amendment A1, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, say nay. Motion prevails and the A1 amendment is adopted. Representative Myers, please explain your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, Lead Moeller, members. This is actually one of the largest committees I've been to. There's a lot of members in this room. So, thank you for hearing this bill. This was actually brought to me by a sheriff's deputy, but this is a bill related to public safety and a deterrent on assaults of law enforcement workers in our county jail. This bill is going to require consecutive sentences for inmates convicted of assaulting detention staff at our local facilities. I do have a few testifiers here today that can speak to the specifics.
Have your testifiers state their name and begin your testimony.
Jamie Ness.
Begin your testimony.
I've worked with the sheriff's office for 10 years in a jail, and I've also worked 2 years in courts, so I have a lot of background as far as the way that this has played out in our county jails. If you have any questions regarding the specifics of the bill, I can more than happy to answer them. But basically, what it does is it takes an assault that happens in custody, and it treats it almost like a separate offense, because what happens when you're pre-sentenced is they tend to combine the sentencing for the assault that happens in custody with the other charges for why they're in jail, and then they get sentenced concurrently. So we've had some major assaults in jails before. There's a few that have made the news, and basically what this does is it feels like a sense of justice for the people that actually get assaulted, and it treats it no different than the DOC. So that way there's extra time added on. It's added as a deterrent to possibly help mitigate assaults. And that's kind of what it does.
Well, thank you, Mr. Wise. Ness, I'm sorry. I say Wise because I see Sheriff Wise sitting over there. And is he a testifier in this bill also, Mr. Myers, Representative Myers?
Yes, he is, Mr. Chair.
Please Please state your full name for the record, and welcome to the committee, Sheriff Wise.
Thank you. My name is Brad Wise. Thank you, Mr. Chair, committee members. As the deputy mentioned, this is all about the safety of the deputies that are working in a detention center. We have to have a disincentive for people to assault the staff, so I'm here to speak on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. So thank you for the opportunity to speak. I am representing the 87 elected sheriffs across the state. My name is Brad Wise. I am the sheriff of Anoka County, and I appreciate the chance to discuss the importance of House File 135 in enhancing the safety and security of our county jails. Ensuring the safety of all individuals within our correctional facilities, including staff, inmates, and visitors, is a paramount concern for sheriffs statewide. Unfortunately, assaults on correctional employees by inmates are not uncommon and pose significant risks to the orderly operation of our facilities. House File 135 addresses this critical issue by mandating that if an inmate in a county jail or local correctional facility commits an assault against a county sheriff or sheriff's correctional employee, the sentence for that assault will run consecutively to any existing sentences. This legislative change is necessary for several reasons. First, it serves as a deterrent by making it clear that violent behavior will result in additional consecutive time added to an inmate sentence. Second, it ensures accountability, reinforcing that inmates will face serious consequences for assaulting law enforcement or correctional employees while in custody. Lastly, and most importantly, it provides greater protection for our correctional employees who work in inherently dangerous environments. These professionals deserve to know that the law recognizes the risks they face and that there are strong measures in place to discourage acts of violence taken against them. The implementation of consecutive sentencing for these assaults underscores Minnesota's commitment to maintaining secure correctional facilities and safeguarding those who serve within them. It sends a clear message that violence against correctional employees will not be tolerated and will be met with meaningful consequences. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association supports House File 135 and urges its passage to enhance the safety of our county jails and to protect the dedicated individuals who work within them. Thank you for your time and commitment to public safety. I'm available to answer any questions you may have.
Thank you, Sheriff. Members, are there questions for Representative Myers or his testifiers? Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Chair, and thank you, Representative Myers, and thanks especially to the testifiers for your work. I want to make sure that folks, that everybody in our who are in custody is safe, and those who are interacting with them as well. One thing that I'm trying to figure out here: many of the people who are in jail are there awaiting a trial. You know, they're still considering what the status is for them, and if somebody in that circumstance were to receive a probationary sentence on the underlying crime, which is, I think, a pretty common thing, would they then go back to prison? Can you just talk about how that would work? Because that's different, obviously, the underlying language. Somebody who is in prison currently has been convicted, so then there's a consecutive sentence on the one that they're serving. But people in jail are not necessarily serving a sentence. So if you could talk about how that would work.
Sounds like a question for Sheriff Wise.
Yeah, that's fine, Mr. Chair, members. Yeah, as was mentioned before, it'd be treated as a completely separate crime. And I don't think it's hard to imagine if somebody is in jail and know they're facing serious consequences. I mean, most of our inmates are pre-sentence inmates, at least in Anoka County Jail. They might think they have nothing to lose by assaulting a staff member. And that's the piece that we're trying to disincentivize. So if they know, so for instance, if I'm an inmate and I know that I'm likely to get probation, you can see there would be a very strong disincentive to assault the staff if I know that I will get jail time for assaulting the staff.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess, so Sheriff, what I'm saying is though, if that person will be getting a probationary sentence on the underlying offense, the way I think the bill is written and the way it would work is that that person would be placed on probation. They'd be out in the community. They'd be working the probation officer. They'd be doing everything they do in the community. Then after that probationary sentence is served, they would then, potentially 2 years later, then they go to a prison and receive a prison sentence because they'd be consecutive to the probationary sentence. I think that's how the bill works. I think there's a lot to like about the concept here. I'd like to talk about it, but I think that the way this is written, that is how things would work.
I think I can probably.
Representative Pinto, I'd like to point out that line 1.22, so the inmate is not entitled to credit against the sentence imposed for the assault for the time served in confinement for the earlier sentence. Does that help, or?
And Mr. Chair, yeah, no. So that's a separate issue. Just to be sure we're clear on what I'm talking about is that if somebody's pre-sentence, they're then convicted of a crime that results in a probationary sentence, which is most often the case, then they would be, the way this is written, they'd be placed on probation, and then eventually they would come back and go to prison. They wouldn't get any credit for the time they spent in jail, it's true, but they'd be on probation and then they go back to prison later on for the assault that they committed while they were in jail.
Sheriff Wise, do you have an opinion?
Mr. Chair, I think it's important to think of this as a separate incident that would just be prosecuted separately, and that if somebody was on probation for their underlying crime, I could imagine, I would hope that the bill would give the judge freedom to sentence the person separately for the assault on the correctional staff.
And
Chair, Mr. Chair, could not.
If you stand by just a second, Representative Myers, Mr. Johnson has an opinion on this.
Mr. Chair, members, I think that as drafted, what it requires is that the sentence for assault be executed and be required to be served consecutively to the underlying sentence, which means that sentence must happen after whatever the underlying sentence is, so after whatever the person is in jail for, and then that sentence must also be executed as drafted. So if the person is placed on probation for, say, up to 5 years, they would complete their period of probation, and then the consecutive sentence would apply, and it is required in the language that it be executed. I'll point out this is similar to some existing language related to the escape statute. The escape statute, however, is permissive to the courts. This would be mandatory.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Pinto, does that help you? Or
it does, yeah. So that confirms my concern, Mr. Chair. And I will note that escape from custody statute 609485, it does provide, and I think I heard the sheriff referencing this, the court has the ability to not necessarily sentence consecutive. The court can specify a concurrent term. That would especially make sense in the situation described by Mr. Johnson I'm referencing as well. So to confirm it's somebody who's in custody awaiting their trial, they then, on that charge, they end up getting a probationary sentence, which is often going to be the case. They then serve several years on probation. It maybe wouldn't make a lot of sense at that point for them to come back and get a consecutive sentence and then have to go to prison at that point several years later. I know I don't think that's what the author and the testifiers are aiming at. We just would want to avoid that kind of circumstance.
Representative Myers and I think Mr. Ness also has something. So, Mr. Ness, would you like to go first?
So, typically what happens is once they're sentenced, if they're going to probation, if it's like a presumptive prison commit, that would be completely different than an actual probation. So if they're going to probation and then they get rid out of a prison if they come back from probation and they appear on the assault, if they have a prison commit based off of the assault that they have, then they would end up in prison and the probation would be used as like a criminal history. So in essence, it kind of changes the way that they would view the criminal history when they're sentencing for the assault. So if there's because you can still be sentenced on a separate issue while you're on probation. Mm-hmm. So all it would do is if there's a presumptive prison commit for the assault that was committed in jail, then they would end up going to prison for that, and the probation would be used as a criminal history.
Does that Representative make sense? Myers.
No, thank you, Chair. All I'll add to that is, Representative Pinto, thanks for bringing that up. I like that you like the idea as well as, supporting our correction officer in this situation. So, what I would say is I look forward to working with you on looking at that.
Representative Pinto, we're working on some things. Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I'm not quite sure yet, and maybe we can get a little more clarity again. I do think that how Representative Pinto described it with the probation sentence would happen first, and then the prison sentence under this would happen second. And I just want to verify one more time that that's in effect how this would work.
Mr. Johnson.
Mr. Chair, Representative Moeller, members, the language as written here requires the assault sentence to be consecutive to the other sentence, meaning that the sentence that the person is in jail for must be completed first before the sentence for the assault begins to run. And so if the underlying sentence that the person is in custody for is a sentence that results in a probationary period, that probationary period would need to run and expire before the sentence for the assault is imposed. The sentence for the assault would be required to be executed, which means that if it was a jail sentence or a prison sentence, depending on the degree, and it would almost certainly be a prison sentence given that it's a correctional officer, it would result in that person being on probation for up to 5 years, depending on the underlying offense, and then going to prison after that time runs.
Thank you, Mr. Johnson. Representative Moeller, sounds like we have some work to do on this. Anything you say, we're going to be laying this over.
Yeah.
So.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I won't belabor this. I just want to say that no assault or violence against our staff working in jails is acceptable. And so I definitely want to work together and find a solution on this. And I'm wondering if it's something about kind of the order of operations here, where that this would get sentenced first, perhaps. I don't know if that could work, but we're definitely willing to work on it. I just think the way it's drafted now creates a very weird circumstance.
Thank you. Closing, Representative Myers.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, members. You know, I think this is a important piece to ensure that workplace safety for our public servants that are working inside of our jails. And I look forward to working with members in this to make sure that we're protecting them. Thanks.
Thank you. With that, House File 135, as amended, is laid over with possible further amending. Thank you, Representative Myers, and your testifiers. The next bill on the agenda is 538, House File 538. Representative Steer, please come to the testifier table with your testifiers. Representative Steers, you are a member of the committee. Would you like to move House File 538 before this committee with a recommendation it is re-referred to the General Register?
Yes, I would. That's my motion.
Representative Steer, please begin your testimony.
All right. My testimony will be brief. I want to give the testifiers enough time. So House File 538 is a bill that would reinsert the word apparent before death or great bodily harm. And I'll pass it off to the testifiers.
Testifiers, please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Imran Ali. Good afternoon, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. I'm the General Counsel for the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. And today I'm providing testimony in support for House File 538 in regards to a 2020 legislative amendment to Minnesota Statute 609-066. Amongst the changes, one important word was removed, and that important word is apparent. As all of you in this room are aware, in 2020, police reform was front and center at the Capitol. At that time, the legislature passed sweeping reform on Minnesota Statute 609-066, which authorizes deadly force for peace officers given certain circumstances. My testimony is not meant to be controversial, partisan, or meant to cause any confusion. It's really meant to provide some consistency with the legislative intent that was also passed in that very same session. Although it's an easy analysis and it's an easy fix to bring back the word apparent, just like high school math, I need to show my work. So if you can please bear with me as I give just a brief history of not only legislatively, but what has happened over the course of the last few decades shaping use of force law. Four important changes back in 2020 passed. The first one was that Minnesota Statute 609-066 was amended to add legislative intent under the newly created Subdivision 1A. Second, the word apparent was removed from 609-066 Subdivision 2, paren 1. Since the inception of Minnesota Statute 609-066, it has always read, quote, to protect a peace officer or another from apparent death or great bodily harm. And third, if an objectively reasonable officer would believe, based on the totality of circumstances known to the officer at the time and without the benefit of hindsight, that language was also added to bolster the legislative intent from Subdivision 1A. And fourth, the legislature added that a peace officer would have to articulate with specificity before raising a defense under 609-066. That portion was challenged in court, and the chief judge, Judge Castro in Ramsey County, found that by the law enforcement officer in that statute infringed on the constitutional rights which compels an accused to provide a statement. And in 2023, this body, this legislature, amended to remove that requirement, consistent with the order from Judge Castro. Our association, Mr. Chair, and members of the committee and lawyers believe that the removal of the word apparent is inconsistent with our longstanding law and inconsistent with the legislative changes to Minnesota Statute 609-066 that were enacted the exact same time as the removal of the word apparent. What do I mean by that? In 1985, a landmark U.S. Supreme Court case, Tennessee versus Gardner, was decided that provided officers may not use deadly force unless there was a threat of death or great bodily harm. This opinion was a bright line rule and viewed by law enforcement that it didn't account for those situations in which law enforcement officers had to make split-second decisions. In other words, law enforcement had to be practically certain of death or great bodily harm before using deadly force. I think the case law that have arisen post-Tennessee versus Gardner really gets into the weeds of it nearly being impossible for a licensed officer, given the dynamic nature of these incidences, to fall under the guise or front of the holding of Tennessee versus Gardner. And it wasn't until 1989 the U.S. Supreme Court again took this case up with a landmark ruling in Graham versus Connor. In that opinion, it states, and I quote, the reasonableness inquiry in an excessive force case is an objective one. The question whether the officer's actions are objectively reasonable in the light of the facts and circumstances confronting them without regard to their underlying intent or motivation. The reasonableness of a use of force case must be judged from the perspective of a reasonable officer on the scene rather than that with 20/20 vision of hindsight. I would note for the members of the committee, I have not viewed all of the policies and procedures that are governing not only our sheriff's offices, our 87 sheriff's offices around the state, but also our police departments. They incorporate this very quote or a variation of it into the policies and procedures. In 2020, along with the removal of the word, legislative intent was added under Subdivision 1A, paren 3. And I really want to draw a distinction to this because I think it's important. The same legislature that removed that word apparent also drafted this legislative intent that reads, I quote, the decision by a peace officer to use deadly force shall be evaluated from the perspective of a reasonable officer in the same situation based on the totality of circumstances known or perceived by the officer at the time, rather than that with the benefit of hindsight, and that the totality of circumstances shall account for occasions when officers are forced to make quick judgments about the use of deadly force. As you can see, Graham versus Connor, and the quote that I gave you is almost identical to our legislative intent in prong 3 of Subdivision 1A. As a career-long prosecutor and defense attorney, it is rare to have legislative intent for any section in Chapter 609. But here it helps us, and it gives us all clarity today of the intent of the changes, whether we take them in part or take them in whole. A parent is defined, and this is according to the Law Dictionary online. I wish I had a better source, but this is all I got right now. But the word apparent is obvious, evident, or manifest what appears or has been made to manifest. So by removing the word, we would essentially be inconsistent with our own legislative intent that we enacted back in 2020. What may be evident or obvious or manifest would be the perception and the perspective from the officer on the scene without the benefit of hindsight being 2020. And I'll leave the committee with this very briefly. Attorney General Keith Ellison, in a written memorandum on a use of force case in April of 2022, states in part, I quote, "The statute requires the evaluation of a peace officer's decision to use deadly force be made from the perspective of a reasonable peace officer in the same situation based on the totality of circumstances known to or perceived by the officer at the time, rather than that with the benefit of hindsight." And it quotes Minnesota Statute 609-066, Subdivision 1A3, which is the legislative intent that I just read into the record. Under this statute, the quote from Attorney General Ellison goes on, "Under the statute, the totality of circumstances shall also account for occasions when officers may be forced to make quick judgments about using deadly force. There are relevant factors that the statute requires to be considered in whether under the totality of circumstances a peace officer's use of deadly force is justified. This language in this statute adopts, to the extent, the legal standard prescribed in Graham versus Connor." And so, ladies and gentlemen, I do think it is an easy fix, and I think that it provides that consistency that we have with our legislative intent and also our changes to the actual scope of deadly force as well. I'll now pass it on to my colleague from the MPPOA.
Mr. Meyer, state your full name and begin your testimony.
Mr. Chair and members, my name is Shane Myrie, and I'm the current president of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association, or MPPOA. I'm here today in support of House File 538, which clarifies the current statute by adding the word apparent to Subdivision 2A1 of Minnesota Statute 609-066. Mr. Ali testified about the legislative history, the intricacies of statutory language, and case law, which I know are all topics members of this committee can't get enough of. However, as president of MPPOA, I'd like to briefly speak to the communities across the state of Minnesota, as well as the licensed peace officers across the state of Minnesota. The proposed change today is not a substantive change in the operation of the current authorized use of deadly force by peace officer statute. The proposed change does not modify the current review standard and statute, which is one that objectively reasonable officer would believe based on the totality of the circumstances known to the officer at the time and without the benefit of hindsight. Nor does it modify the legislative intent of the statute, which includes the following language: deadly force shall be evaluated from the perspective of a reasonable officer in the same situation based on the totality of the circumstances known or perceived by the officer at the time. This change merely clarifies the language in Subdivision 2A1 to more thoroughly capture the current review standard in effect right now in Minnesota, which is based on existing case law. We believe clarifying the language makes the statute more transparent, and this benefits communities across the state of Minnesota, as well as licensed peace officers in Minnesota. Mr. Chair and members, thank you for your time this afternoon.
Thank you, Mr. Meyer. We have two more testifiers signed up, Chief Henthorn and Sergeant Murray. Chief, you're first. State your full name and begin your testimony.
Jay Henthorn.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members of the committee. My name is Jay Henthorn. I'm the Chief of Police of the City of Richfield. I am here today representing the Minnesota Chiefs of Police Association. We represent over 300 chiefs, along with 150 command staff members in the state of Minnesota. Having heard testimony, and my comments will be brief, having heard testimony today from MPPOA and the testimony today from Sergeant Murray from the Burnsville Police Department, including our own review of the changes in House File 538, we support the changes along with our collaborative partners from the MPPOA and the Minnesota Sheriff's Association. We want to thank Representative Steer for bringing the change forward and look forward to working with him on this bill. Thank you for your time today.
Thank you. Sergeant Murray, state your full name and begin your testimony, please.
Yeah, my name is Brent Murray, Sergeant with the Burnsville Police Department. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for the opportunity to share a perspective on support of this bill. Officers in Minnesota work under 609066, a law we hope never to have to need, but vitally important to understand. It also be able to apply on calls that are rapidly evolving, involving the fear of being killed and the need for split-second decisions to save lives. As officers, we continue to work hard to keep our communities safe, never knowing which call could create a level of danger that our families worry each time we leave. In April 2021, an incident impacted my family and my life, and being one of the first to be reviewed by the change of this deadly force statute. An individual endangered the lives of citizens and officers, forcing officers into these decisions on the use of deadly force. While processing the event, I had my wife come to be with me while going through the critical incident, leaving children at home, hoping not to expose them, if possible, to what was happening. Although that was futile, as they know and feel what the family is going through. As my wife and I sat at the police station, I could hear officers moving around on the roof, planning security for us at the station for what could be an unknown event. I recall sitting there wondering how in the world I was going to get my wife away from their home safe to our children. I was concerned and worried about the safety of my family. Our friends, families, and colleagues tried to support us through this time. However, questions were being asked, the times we were under, the application of law. What next? Could we lose our freedom, livelihood, homes, and further impact our families? We had to wait hours that day, weeks home alone on leave, and ultimately many months as the criminal investigation transpired. I'm not alone, as other officers have had to go through similar. I only hope anything I've shared here today helps give some perspective and understanding of just some of the experiences officers go through. As I come to an end, I also want to point to 609066 legislative intent. As they use the words known or perceived by the officer at the time, I feel that the legislative intent already creates that need for understanding, and adding the word apparent carries forward that same intent. Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee, for listening and hopefully carrying this bill forward and supporting all officers and families in Minnesota. Thank you.
Thank you, Sergeant Murray and Chief Henthorn. Any questions for the testifiers? Representative Pinto.
I'll let the lead go second, Mr. Chair. I guess I just am confirming I heard the chief, or heard it said before that the intent is not to change any, to modify the standard at all here, and just to clarify the language. And I guess I'm just concerned, this is maybe to Representative Steer, I guess, is how, if it's not to change the standard at all, I guess I get concerned that when we add words, you know, courts are going to believe that, in fact, we intend to make some sort of change. That's why the legislature does things. And kind of what you'd expect the impact of the change to be legally, because I would think the court would think that there'd be some sort of change that we could get. So if you could just kind of provide thoughts on that. Maybe Mr. Overby, maybe come.
What's that? Representative Steer.
Okay. Here.
I'm going to
turn to counsel.
Yeah, sorry. I'm going to defer that to Imran Ali. I think he can better answer the question.
Mr. Ali.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Pinto, great question. It's one of those things that I've been debating as well. It doesn't change the standard, it provides the consistency. When you look at that word, a parent was removed for a reason back in 2020. And there was also legislative intent that was added in there. And as Sergeant Murphy said, the use of the word perception or perceive is apparent. And so it's inconsistent to remove the word apparent to take away the perspective of an officer. Now, by taking the word apparent out, it gets us to that Tennessee versus Gardner standard, which is that practical certainty, which is different from the Graham versus Connor in 1989.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess I'm confused. So if apparent, I remember from this time after the death of George Floyd, it was, you know, really intense negotiations. I appreciate, I don't know who included in our packets the that House File 1 materials, Chair, and on page 7 were the changes that were made in 2020, and there's a lot of language that was added at the time. It was very carefully negotiated, and I guess it does make sense to me, as Mr. Ali is saying, a parent was removed for a reason as part of a whole package of other changes, and then now we're putting it back. And I'm like saying, like, well, now wait a second. Can we point to anything in particular, any court ruling, anything that make us say that in fact it needs to be put back, because it was taken out for a reason, all these changes were made for a reason, carefully balancing a lot of things. I guess I'm unclear about what the effect of putting it back in then would be, and I think that makes me quite nervous. Mr. Ali, may I have more comments, Mr. Ali, may, Mr. Chair?
Mr. Chair, was that a Representative, question
or Mr. Ali.
Of the 50 states that I've reviewed as it relates to authorized use of deadly force, they have a language in there about perception. Even our own Minnesota statute on self-defense has that as well. And so this is just to be in line with the legislative intent. I can't go back, Representative Pinto, to 2020, and I know that there was a lot of negotiations going back and forth about that language. Just as can be articulated with specificity by a law enforcement officer was deemed unconstitutional by Judge Castro, and later in 2023, this is us simply going back and saying the legislative intent and the changes to subdivision 2 of 609.066 to add the objective reasonableness has to be consistent, and the removal of the word apparent makes it inconsistent.
Mr. Chairman, just final comment before I turn things back to Lead Moeller, if I can. It's okay, Mr. Chair? I'm just going to make a final comment if I can, Mr. Chair.
Go ahead, Mr. Pinto.
Thank you.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you. Thank you, Chair. So I guess if I look at the language as it existed before 2020, which, again, it's nicely available to us on this page 7, it previously said that use of deadly force is justified only when to protect the peace officer or another from apparent death or great bodily harm. The way that as I look at this and I'm reminded of what happened in 2020, what we basically did was took out the word apparent and replaced it with a whole lot of language on page 7 of that document, providing a lot of legislative intent, which I'm hearing the officers saying they really appreciate, providing that that there's a lot of perception that's in there and a lot of detail. What worries me is that this is going back on those reforms. It's either doing nothing, in which case we really shouldn't be doing anything here, or it is in fact going back on a carefully negotiated set of reforms. Remember, this is, one thing that's unique to Minnesota is what happened to George Floyd, the death of George Floyd. There was a lot of negotiation that came out of it, and it resulted in some language changes that I gather have worked quite well. I'm not hearing any substantive concerns, simply saying, well, we need to add a word to clarify. I get very worried that adding a word that wouldn't have a legal effect, but that somehow would clarify, you add words, they do have legal effects. And when I look at what we did in 2020 and taking out this word and replacing it, we should not be putting it back in my view. So thanks. I'll turn things to Lead Moeller, Mr. Chair.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Steer, for bringing this bill. Also, thank you to our law enforcement. I know you have to make split-second decisions that are life-threatening, and so I do want to acknowledge that and appreciate that. I do share some of the same concerns that Representative Pinto has, primarily because we were around when this was carefully negotiated. I know MPPOA participated in those negotiations, and my understanding was at the time a parent was removed because some of these other factors were added in, and they're not changed now, but on line 1.14 to 1.16, Those other additional factors were added in when a parent was removed. But I do see, and I maybe have a possible suggestion here, I do see that the legislative intent that you provided, that's on page 7 of the handout, when it says, based on the totality of the circumstances known to or perceived by the officer at that time, rather than the benefit of hindsight and the totality of circumstances, et cetera. I am looking on the bill at line 1.9 to 1.11. So that intent is repeated again. I'll let people get there, sorry. I've been thinking about this for a while, so I was ready. If you look at the bill at line 1.9 to 1.11, it says, a reasonable officer would believe, based on the totality of the circumstances, known to the officer at the time and without the benefit of hindsight, that such force is necessary to protect, et cetera. And so I think what I heard your testifier say was the word perceived was missing from here. And so I'm wondering if instead of adding the word apparent back in, that basically the intent that you provided with the packet would be put into the language so it would be known or perceived, and it would still be an objective test. We don't want it to be a subjective test. I'm wondering if that will get to what you're saying about the inconsistencies without creating, which I think the word apparent creates more confusion.
Mr. Ali.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moeller, just to clarify, and I apologize, I was trying to go through the bill and then also the packet in the bill as well. Is what you're suggesting is rather than putting the word apparent back in there is to leave the word apparent out but to add language in subdivision? Or if you can just, I guess a point of clarification, if you can just repeat, I guess, what the recommendation would be.
Yes.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you. Yes, so it would be in subdivision 2, paragraph A, because right there, right in that subdivision, you're already really reiterating what the legislative intent language says, that it's objectively reasonable. An objectively reasonable officer would believe, based on the totality of the circumstances known to the officer at the time without benefit of hindsight, that such force is necessary. You could somehow add in perceived that would match the legislative intent that's in subdivision 1A. Of the statute. I just would want to make sure that it's not a subjective test. It would still be an objective test at that point.
Representative, or Mr. Ali.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Representative Moeller, that is a definitely one solution. It's a solution that appears sitting here right now. Looks to be some that kind of strikes that balance between taking a word, removing a word, and adding some clarity to it. It's something definitely that I would work with you on.
Representative Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Mr. Ali, for that. And I would just say, you know, I've met with the law enforcement organizations a lot. Wasn't on any of the priority lists, and I really wish this had been brought to our attention before we saw the bill being heard for committee, because we would have been glad to work together and work this out, and I would really hope, Mr. Chair, that you'd entertain laying this over so that we can work on this language.
That was already part of the plan, Representative Moeller. It's way too important to deal with. I can't think of a more important one-word bill. And it's a little out of the ordinary, but I did jump over Representative Engen, my mistake. Representative Engen, can you give a brief comment, and then we'll move to layover if there's
Thank
no other
you, Mr.
questions.
Chair, and sorry, Lead Moeller. Wanted to include this. In the tragic incident of the death of Officer Mitchell, there was no apparent need to protect yourself or others from great bodily harm or death. But things change on a whim, and that standard then needs to be applied to the use of force necessary to protect yourself and others. So that apparent standard was not there, and if we were to add it back in, that provides our law enforcement officers with another tool when those circumstances change. So just wanted to cite that.
Representative Hollins.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I've just got one really important question. Representative Steer, is this your second bill in this committee?
Does this have to do with snacks or treats?
Representative.
It sure does.
All right, with that, we will be moving to lay this over for clarification, and this is very important. We'll get this taken care of. Now, the next file up today is bill on our agenda is House File 7. We heard this bill in public safety on February 11th and took testimony at that time. We'll not be taking any testimony on this bill today. We'll be referring it to judiciary where we amended it to put in the guardrails on law enforcement tracking of stolen vehicles, which include not placing the devices on private property per request of some of the members here. Judiciary sent back the bill to public safety because of the fiscal note that had not been received, but we knew there would be a cost to it. The fiscal note has now been received, and the bill does have a cost, so I will be recommending this bill be re-referred to Ways and Means. Before making this motion, however, and I should note that in speaking with Lead Moeller, we have agreed that I just stay here during this technical time while we're moving this bill. Before making the motion, I have an amendment coded 8-8 that strips out sections 2 and 3 of the bill. This is another request by a member that we agreed to take out. This section required offenders convicted of criminal sexual conduct offense who received a stay of adjudication be registered to as a predatory offender. So I move the A8 amendment before the committee for adoption. Discussion on A8. Lead Moeller? Anyone else? All in favor of adopting A8, say aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries and the A8 is adopted. We'll be requesting a revised fiscal note on the bill with the elimination of the stays of adjudication language. I now move to re-refer House File 7 as amended to Ways and Means.
Mr. Chair.
Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I know that we're awaiting the fiscal note based on the amendment that we just adopted, but I did look at the fiscal note from before, and even with the removal of sections 2 and section 3, we know there's still going to be a fiscal note, and we also know that there's still going to be a note for the public defenders and the judiciary because other sections of the bill created a fiscal result for the defenders and judiciary. And so for that reason, Mr. Chair, I really think that we should be sending this back to judiciary. When they had the bill, they had no vote in front of them. And I would move that we re-refer this to judiciary.
Representative Moeller, it doesn't change the testimony. There's no new information that was provided in judiciary to start with other than the fiscal note and the removal of information. So I don't see why it would need to go back to judiciary.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair, because it actually shouldn't leave this committee either because of the fiscal note, because we don't have the targets. We're going to have the budget forecast is being released this week. It's going to have an impact on both this committee and the judiciary committee. And I think to send it to Ways without having judiciary be able to consider what the impact is to their committee is a problem.
Representative Pinto.
And Mr. Chair, can I ask, because I could understand not sending judiciary if, in fact, the plan is, I mean, most of the funding comes out of our committee. So is the plan, though, to hold it in our committee until we know our budget picture, or are you actually planning to send it out today out of our committee?
Oh, no, we're planning on holding it for now.
I'm sorry, Chair, I couldn't hear that.
You're planning on holding it public safety right now or not pushing it to the floor.
We're not pushing it to the floor. Okay. Until, okay, for now, okay. Okay, thank you, Mr. Chair. I guess so if I'm understanding you right, then you're not calling on us to act on it in the Public Safety Committee right now. So I guess perhaps that means you wouldn't be expecting Judiciary Committee to be acting on it. Hopefully they, presumably they will be called to act on it before you'd be sending it to Ways.
Or Lead Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I guess just for clarity, I thought I had heard you say the intent was to send it to Ways today, to vote it out of committee and send it to Ways. And that's where I think we have some questions and concerns, just because we don't have the completed fiscal note. It's still going to have a cost to this committee. It will also have a cost to Judiciary. And that's why we were asking if we can hold it back and not send it to Ways and Means.
Well, I'm told that we have received reassurances from the fiscal staff that the revised note will be coming shortly. So we will lay it over until we have the fiscal notes back.
Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Ingen is up next. House File 327. Representative Ingen, please come to the table with your testifiers. Representative Ingen, would you like to move House File 327 before the committee?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair. Thank you.
Representative Ingen, the fiscal note came back on your bill showing it has costs, so we'll be laying over File 237 for the possible inclusion in the committee omnibus. Representative Ingen, I believe you also have an author's amendment, DE1. Please explain your amendment.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Before I get to my DE1 amendment, I want to kind of outline for the committee just what we're doing here. Here at the legislature, it's no surprise that we all handle hundreds, if not thousands, of papers throughout the course of a week. And we don't have to worry about touching a piece of paper and having it potentially put us in a hospital, or worse, kill us. Our DOC staff has been doing that every single day for quite some time now. And we should act to try to quell the nearly double violations for illegal drugs that have been intook into our DOC facilities. The mail is the number one source where this is all coming from, by the way. And in 2022, there were 410 violations. 2024, there were 811. And we can see many instances where more than several officers were impacted throughout the course of a single week alone. And so instead of just addressing this via a mail intake system where we're checking to see if there are illicit drugs within those pieces of mail, we should also increase those penalties to a felony level for knowingly introducing this into a DOC facility. And with that, I will answer any questions you guys might have.
So we're back to DE1. Could you explain DE1?
Yes. So this actually came from DFL House Research, so I want to thank you guys. We did have a slight issue with the original language, which would have, it could have been interpreted to say that a person arrested or booked into jail who has contraband on them could be subjected to either the gross misdemeanor penalty for possession or contraband of the felony law for intent to distribute. So it's kind of a catch-22 in that sense. So we wanted to clarify that language.
Lead Mueller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Ingen. I know we had spotted some things and our staff worked out this amendment. I do still have some questions about the breadth of this amendment. I think for purposes of now, it's fine if we adopt it, and then I can speak to those questions, and hopefully we can work together on a solution. Thanks.
Any more questions on DE1? All those in favor of DE1 say aye.
Aye.
Those opposed say nay. Amendment carried. There's another amendment at the table, DE2. The A2, I'm sorry. So it's okay, we'll hear the testimony on the bill and then take A2. Representative Ingen, do you have any other further testimony on the bill? Do you have testifiers?
I believe so.
Sheriff Wise.
Awesome. Welcome back, Sheriff Wise. Please state your name and begin your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. My name is Brad Wise. I'm the sheriff of Anoka County. So, good afternoon, and thank you for the opportunity to speak today on behalf of the Minnesota Sheriffs Association. I represent all 87 elected sheriffs across the state. I appreciate to highlight the importance of House File 327 and why it's critical to ensuring the safety and security of our county jails. The introduction of contraband, whether weapons, particularly drugs, or other dangerous materials, poses a serious and immediate threat to everyone inside a correctional facility. This includes detention staff, inmates, medical personnel, even visitors. Sheriffs and jail administrators work diligently to prevent contraband from entering the facility, but current penalties do not adequately deter individuals from attempting to smuggle in illegal or dangerous items. When contraband makes its way into a facility, it can fuel violence, disrupt operations, endanger staff, and facilitate criminal activity within the jail. House File 327 strengthens the penalties for introducing contraband, sending a clear message these actions will not be tolerated. Elevating certain offenses from gross misdemeanors to felonies is a necessary step to hold offenders accountable and provide stronger deterrence. Increasing penalties for introducing dangerous weapons and illicit substances ensures that those who seek to compromise the safety of our jails face meaningful consequences. County jails are already high-risk environments, and ensuring they remain secure is not just a public safety issue, it is about protecting the individuals in our custody, as well as the men and women who serve our communities in these facilities every day. Strengthening contraband laws enhance our ability to maintain order, prevent violence, and keep our personnel and inmates safe. The Minnesota Sheriff's Association strongly supports House File 327 and urges its passage to help ensure our county jails remain secure. Thank you for your time.
Thank you, Sheriff. Are there any other questions for Representative Engen or Sheriff Weiss? Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. So I did have a question as to whether or not this was intended to apply to the DOC correctional facilities as well, or is your intent, Representative Engen, just to apply to the local jails?
Representative Engen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Lead Moeller. My intention is for it to apply to both.
Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And I was alerted to the fact that there is a separate statute related to DOC. It's 243.55, where I think it's already a felony to bring in contraband to a correctional facility. And I don't know, and I think this was maybe an issue we brought to your attention before I knew about this statute. So I'm not trying to be confusing here, but I just learned of this statute, and I know that the Commissioner of Corrections is here, and I wonder if it would be helpful to hear from him what they have for the DOC facilities now. And also, I know they've purchased some new equipment to help address some of the problems that you have identified, at least with respect to their facilities.
Yeah.
Commissioner Snell, would you? Now, Commissioner Snell, I know Lead Moeller talked about the steps you've taken. If you could keep that, I plan to have a hearing dedicated to that later on. So if you can talk about the mail mitigation briefly, but we'll cover that more. But Mr. Snell, say your full name and begin answering the question.
Mr. Chair, members, Paul Schnell, the Commissioner at the Department of Corrections. Thank you for the opportunity to speak to this. I also want to thank Representative Engen for bringing this forward. There is currently a statute that speaks specifically to the introduction of controlled substances, weapons, firearms, weapons or explosives of any kind into the facility, which is a 10-year felony under the existing DOC language versus the 2-year felony here, as I understand the one of the key differences. And then there is a gross misdemeanor provision that speaks more specifically to bringing in contraband, specifically alcohol, into a facility. So I think that's the key, one of the key differences, and I think there could be some mechanisms of merging some of this language as we go forward. The one thing I would say, and while we have been really heavily focused on trying to ensure accountability and In 2024, the Department of Corrections referred 24 cases for criminal prosecution to local prosecutors as a result of investigations that took place. And many instances where we do not have evidence to meet the criminal threshold, we then pursue those cases through the disciplinary process. But one of the things that was a major concern, obviously, for staff and we became aware of was that that much of the drugs, especially the synthetic drugs that were coming in on paper, were being sent in through the mail. As a result of the sickness to many of our staff who were impacted by this, we introduced and did an emergency procurement process to hire a third-party contractor who now receives mail, scans that mail, photocopies it, and then sends it to the facilities for staff to distribute. The contractor has facilities set up specifically to meet this need and in a safe environment so that their staff, it's all hooded settings and those sorts of things to be able to do this. And I will say that, you know, that this has been significant, and to your point, Mr. Chair, I won't belabor this, but I can say that we've seen roughly a two-thirds reduction in the number of incidents of suspected illegal drug possession in the facilities or intoxication in the facilities from this use. And so it does show some indication that it is working.
Yes, Chair. Commissioner Sell, yes, I did meet with many members of your staff that have reported the increase in manufacturing a hooch in the cells, but much less in the drugs. Lead Moeller?
Yeah, thank you, Mr. Chair. So I think maybe trying to figure out how your bill would interact with the DOC's bill would be an important next step. And then the other thing I would say is I just think it's still a little broad. If you look at line 1.9, and it refers to cell having the meaning given in section 15201 subdivision 15A. I don't have that right up in front of me, but it's a pretty broad definition of cell. It's like possessed with intent to sell, barter for, exchange. That coupled with the fact that contraband is defined on line 1.6, referencing statute 15201 subdivision 4, is also a very large list. And so I guess I could foresee a situation where maybe someone who's incarcerated has prescription medication for some kind of control that's technically a controlled substance and barters that for a candy bar, and then that person would be guilty of a felony. And so I think there's maybe a little more refinement, especially trying to get at the issue that you've identified, which is a real issue. And I understand that jails don't have the ability to have that same kind of equipment that the DOC has. And so maybe there's some way to refine it a little bit so it's not quite so broad.
Was that a question, Lee Moeller?
It's just a comment.
I just want to make sure I got it right. Representative Engen.
Thank you for that, Lead Moeller, as well as Commissioner Schnell. My intent is also to get at the folks who are sending this into our facilities. It's not just the folks who are taking it in, an incarcerated individual. So that's where we're seeing a lot of this. And I want to read for you guys here from KSTP. They found a case in Lionel Lakes, where I represent, that federal and local officers broke up a conspiracy involving several incarcerated and outside network folks who are sending this in. And they discovered strips of Suboxone mixed into the glue of some envelopes. And then in a different case here, we had either a corrections officer or food service workers who had been delivering THC gummies, ecstasy pills, and other contraband to inmates at the Minnesota Sex Offender Facility in Moose Lake. So this isn't just a case where it's the folks on the inside. People on the outside who are providing that supply, and we want to get after that as well and say, no, we're not going to put up with this anymore.
Thank you, Representative Engen. And yeah, I believe speaking to the thing, it was we had looking at a situation, it was obvious that there was some pretty sophisticated means that there was the ink in books, and it wasn't just letters that were being sent in. Lead Moeller's got concerns over the conflicting, and what do we do with that, and what happens with the existing conflicting laws. Is there House nonpartisan that could clarify for Lead Moeller on that question?
Mr. Chair and members.
Mr. Diebel.
Yes. I think the since we're working on this, it should be reconciled now rather than enacting two conflicting provisions. Right. So I think we have the opportunity now to fix the problem because you have the federal, you have the one statute that governs the DOC, and the definition used in the amendment is broad enough that it would include DOC facilities. So it should be, now's the time to fix
that. So we need to get this fixed before it goes any further.
Chair. Oh.
Representative Pinto.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yeah, I might suggest to Representative Engen that just the DOC be removed altogether and just focus, because it seems like that's covered pretty well under 243.55. I'll note that if this bill went into effect, it would actually have a lower penalty than the existing statute for introducing contraband into a correctional facility, two-year felony instead of a 10-year felony. It would actually have a higher penalty, though, for introducing, bringing beer or alcohol into a prison. Right now, that's a gross misdemeanor. This would make that a felony. So maybe the simple thing is just at least for consideration to kind of say correctional facility, state correctional facilities we're doing pretty well on, but there are concerns with jails. And I've actually charged, I mean, I can think of several cases I've charged, in fact, where folks have tried to send in drugs into jails, and certainly a significant concern. But I think we want to focus on the particular problem that we're trying to address. So just for consideration.
Comment, Representative Engen. Representative Whitty. Any other questions for the testifiers on this? Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I'm sorry. So I think there's, you know, just to be clear, there's two issues. One is the DOC issue, and then the other one that I had just made a comment on before, and Representative Engen, you talked about people from the outside bringing things in, and I agree. And I think your bill covers that with line 1.16 to 1.19. The portion that I'm hoping that you're willing to work on still is 1.20 to 1.22. That's where I think it's a little broad for people who are incarcerated. Like I gave the example of trading a prescription pill that they're getting for a candy bar. I don't think that should be a felony. And so that's the area that I really hope we can work on together to narrow a little bit.
Representative Egan.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Lead Moeller. I appreciate the legal perspective into this. We want to do this right. We want to provide those protections for our COs who are going through a tough time right now. And actually, I'll refer you guys to a story that happened 3 weeks ago in my cube at the COB. I met with three different corrections officers, and one gal, she had been working there for 20-some years in Stillwater, and woke up in a hospital bed because she was exposed to something, and to this day she doesn't know what it is. And her workers' comp didn't cover the expenses for the hospital stay and everything else that she had missed because of work. So we do need to do something about this. That much is 100% seems to be mutually understood on both sides of the table here. But I want to work with you on this. Let's get this language right, and then we can get this done. Thank you.
Okay, well, we will now revert back to the A2 amendment. Who is offering the A2 amendment?
That's
Representative
me, Chair.
Curran.
Thank you, Chair. And thank you, Representative Engen. I think we've had a lot of really good discussion. This is an issue in our correctional facilities. Lead Moeller brought up the very real issue of people having access to prescription medications in jail and correctional facilities. The A2, what the A2 really does is bring House File 294 that's authored by Rep. Hanson Jay, incorporating practices to ensure that folks who go through intake are provided with the same medications that they're prescribed unless a nurse says otherwise. Just highlighting, there's an issue with some contraband coming into facilities because people are worried maybe they won't have the right prescriptions or they just happen to have them on them and, didn't go through the right process, et cetera. So want to highlight that there is also an issue where people maybe don't have the right access to medication and health services. And there's all sorts of ways and reasons that medications might come into a facility outside of the sanctioned ways that that's supposed to happen, whether the intention is nefarious or not. And including, too, you know, you mentioned protecting our COs, and I absolutely agree. And I think this bill gets also at another great angle of when those, you know, off chance cases occur that there are COs or other staff involved in the contraband and sort of disseminating those things, that we're addressing that problem seriously too. So I see this as a holistic approach. I do understand that there's interest in maybe giving HF 294 its own hearing. And I know there's more work to be done on this bill specifically. Just wanted to highlight that and appreciate the multifaceted approach to this. With that, Chair, I will withdraw this amendment today.
The A2 amendment has been withdrawn. Member, any further discussion on this bill? Closing your remarks, Representative Ingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, members, for the discussion. Thank you for taking a look at this and helping me refine it and make it a better bill. Notwithstanding the previous A2 amendment, which was withdrawn, I don't think that this is a matter of medications that are that people are going without. When you introduce a meth-soaked Winnie the Pooh greeting card into our DOC facilities and our corrections officers are being exposed to that and then being sent to the hospital at the staggering rates that they are currently, we got to do something about it. And if increasing penalties deters this action from taking place at all, even from one person who might be sending it in, then I think it's worth it. So I appreciate the time and I appreciate the discussion.
House File 327, as amended, is laid over. Thank you, Representative Engen, to you and your testifiers. Next bill on the agenda is House File 1399. Vice Chair Witte, please come to the testifiers' table with your testifiers. Vice Chair Witte, we have not received a financial note on this bill, so we will be laying the bill over for today. Please explain your bill.
Thank you, Chair Novotny and members. House File Number 1399 requires DOC to have sufficient Narcan in the prisons. We've had recent incidents. I had a great conversation with Commissioner Schnell yesterday in some of the steps that they're trying to take. But having ample number of doses in each facility, I think, is important to ensure a rapid response to an opioid overdose, and then also require to train staff on recognizing the symptoms of opioid overdoses. And the piece with it also is, it's not just staff, but it's also the inmates that are in there. So I will, one last stat I'd say is last year there were over 70 suspected OD cases of in the state prisons last year. So that's why I'm asking that there's enough Narcan in each of the facilities.
See, we have a testifier, Mr. Cooley. Could you state your full name and begin your testimony?
Chair Novotny, members of the committee, my name is Will Cooley. I'm the policy director of the Minnesota Justice Research Center. HF 1399 is a smart, compassionate, bipartisan response to our overdose crisis. I have to admit, years ago, I was skeptical that we could thwart the drug addiction crisis with more drugs, especially when pernicious pharmaceutical companies sparked this disaster. However, I now know that access to life-saving medication along with therapy keeps people alive and can reverse the tide of this plague. In this line of work, I've met many individuals who have had their lives saved by Narcan and then had their lives stabilized with drugs like Suboxone. Providing opiate antagonists in correctional facilities is the first step in this process, along with medication-assisted treatment, which can lower the chances of overdose, provide a period of stability, and connect people to addiction treatment before the cravings return. Many supervision agents we've spoken with speak highly of Sublocade injections, for instance, which can diminish withdrawal symptoms for a month at a time. Prisons need these medications, but also county jails. A survey from 2021 found that less than half of county jails offered MAT. Minnesota started a Medicaid 1115 waiver program in 3 prisons and 5 jails. Incarcerated people are provided with Medicaid-covered services within 90 days of release, including case management and a 30-day supply of medications. Jails are a vital place to provide a combination of medicine and behavioral health treatment, but also important to improve the handoff from correctional facilities to community supervision. Supervision agents are primarily tasked with enforcement, but many care deeply about their clients and take pride in providing support, monitoring progress, and connecting them with resources. I recently spoke with an agent who lost a person on her caseload 10 years ago, and she's still haunted by that death. Correction staff and probation agents are on the front lines of the opioid crisis and need evidence-based solutions, like what Representative Witte is providing here with the opioid antagonists, and we also need this medication-assisted treatment to combat the epidemic. HF 1399 is a step in the right direction, and I applaud Representative Witte for bringing this forward.
Vice Chair Witte, do you have any other testifiers?
No other testifiers, and before we get into discussion, my mentee, Representative Rapinski, passed out treats for you guys to sweeten you guys up, so hopefully that makes it go.
The chair duly notes are not homemade.
Thank you.
Representative Johnson, I'm going to guess you've got a little bit of experience you can share with us on this.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Witte. I date myself a little bit. I've been, actually today is my 23rd year anniversary as a professional firefighter. I started my career for a department outside of Denver. I was a paramedic out there. Back then, the only way that we gave Narcan was either IV or through an intubated tube. I went to a number of overdoses early in my career where nobody had any options or solutions to help. And as my career has progressed, I've seen Narcan become a little bit more available. You know, you started carrying nasal Narcan on the ambulances. And then we got it as EMTs on the fire trucks because we saw this rolling through our community and a number of people that we would respond to that we could revive and save where if we had that simple medication. And then you saw it being carried by police officers. And now we will run on calls where citizens have it already, you know, whether it's they have it in case a family member overdoses, whether they have it for themselves. And it has saved lives over and over again. And I commend this bill. This is, to be honest, when I first saw it, I was a little surprised we didn't already have this in place. So it's definitely filling a need and a void for that. These things are very simple to give and buy those precious seconds and precious minutes in order for those responders to get there and take over. So I look forward to signing on to this bill. No real question besides just the surprise it wasn't done sooner. So thank you, Representative Winnie, for bringing it forward. That's really all I have on that one.
Representative Hollins.
Oh, thank you, Mr. Chair. Okay, so it's just showering Representative Witte Day with compliments. Thank you, Representative Witte, for bringing this bill. I do think it's really important, and one of the things that I wanted to make sure that we got on the record and addressed is the fact that sometimes these people are suffering from addiction, but sometimes they've just made a dumb mistake. And I've had several people in my district who have ended up overdosing on opiates, not thinking they were taking opiates. And so I want to recognize that that's a real issue that we're having nowadays where people are taking something else and thinking that it's one thing and it's just not. And so, you know, first of all, nobody deserves to die of a drug overdose, right? But second of all, even if you feel some sort of way about people who are suffering from addiction, I want to recognize that there are also like teenagers and young adults who just made one bad decision and could potentially pay the price with their life. And so if this keeps that from happening, I think it is incredibly necessary and incredibly important. So thank you for bringing it forward.
Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you. Representative Johnson, thanks for your service because that's how I saw it first time. And it was pretty amazing to watch someone come back. when you thought they were gone. And to Representative Holland, you are so right. One of my testifiers who I work with at the Minnesota Twins, she was in Faribault and she was checking a building, came back, didn't feel well. And she suffered from an overdose. And they gave her one Narcan and then they had to give her a second, but that's all they had there at the time. So that's why increasing it, as we saw in Stillwater, there was 10 guards. So if there is a mass incident, you don't want to be picking and choosing who gets the Narcan. So the more we can increase it, I think, is the better. And, you know, on her case, it was just holding an ID, possibly taking off her rubber glove. It wasn't the material, but I learned this, that, you know, probably should have known this from my law enforcement days, probably cutting it with their ID and when she asked for their ID and their card. So it's just making sure we keep people safe and that they have a chance if something bad should happen. So thank you.
So we do have other testifiers. I will have a question for Commissioner Snell if you want to make your way up. And while he's doing that, Representative Curran.
Awesome. Thank you. So, yeah, I might as well shower Representative Witte with another compliment. Thank you so much for this. This is a real problem. We're talking about this in human services, too. And every angle that we can approach this issue at is worthy. And so thank you for bringing this. This is one of those, like Rep. Johnson said, we're not doing this already kind of thing. And so a real problem with a real solution, and I really appreciate it. Just a quick question. I'm curious if this would cover access to Narcan by probation officers who are employed by DOC but maybe don't work in a facility.
Yeah, unfortunately.
Vice Chair Witte.
Sorry, Chair Novotny. Talking to Commissioner Snell, at this point it would not. We'd probably have to add that piece in, but I do think it would be one of those common sense solutions to what we're trying to do here.
Yep. Thank you, Chair. Thank you, Representative Witte. Just wanted to bring that point up. There's a lot of avenues that we can connect people with the right tools to be healthy. So, yeah, happy to have that ongoing conversation, but thank you for this bill.
Thank you.
Before Representative Ream, so just to clarify, Commissioner Snell, I understand that Narcan is available in your facilities, no set amount, and basically we're codifying policy. Would that be fair to say, Commissioner Snell?
Yeah, Mr. Chair, that's correct. This would effectively just codify what is current practice, and we do believe we have, you know, enough quantity available to address any kind of issues, but I think, as has been pointed out, we've had to issue in some instances a number of doses. So but this would codify, and we appreciate that language.
Thank you. Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Novotny, and thank you, Representative Witte, for bringing this bill forward. I was reminded of the fact that we had passed a bill in 2023 to have every public school and every charter school have, I think, two doses of Narcan in the school. And I guess I'm kind of curious if we think that's enough to have. We're talking about ample numbers of doses. I guess I'm kind of curious as to, you know, how much is a good amount to have and if you've, you know, looked into that and how you would define that. And then also just kind of curious if law enforcement officers also carry Narcan.
Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Law enforcement is required to carry it. I think we passed the law on that. I'm getting a thumbs up from Representative Mueller. I didn't put a number on it. We did try to look at it. I do trust that letting corrections figure out what the number is for them and that it's in an accessible area that when you need it, it's rapid response. Having conversations with Commissioner Schnell yesterday, it sounds like they've made some changes as the policy's gone on. So I would, obviously they've had incidents up to 10, you know, a mass incident. So you might have to go higher up. And I think that's for them to decide at that point. But having it readily available, and like I said, sometimes you might have to do it a second time. So I think they will be able to figure that piece out unless you're suggesting we put a number on it.
Representative Ream.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. Thank you, Representative. No, I don't really have much knowledge about how much would be necessary, but it was, you know, when you brought that up, I thought it was kind of interesting to think about how maybe two doses at a high at a school wouldn't be enough. And yeah, and I'm not a lawyer, so I don't know exactly how you'd write that, but you know, ample number of doses leaves a lot to be interpreted. And yeah, I'll leave it at that. Thank you.
Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. The other part is whatever they have, you've already started to roll in medical, outside medical. So you'll have the paramedics rolling in, police officers that will have it, and I think their nursing staff also. So there's a lot of different avenues that we can cover this. So we've all been on the tours. You know, I trust that they will be able to find a good solution that works across the board.
Lead Molars, in light of the testimony and that this is just codifying a policy, how would you feel about referring this to the General Register after a vote?
Mr. Chair, I think it might still have a small cost, so I'm a little hesitant to send it.
Commissioner Snell.
Mr. Chair, at present, we have been filling our supply of Narcan using dollars through a MDH grant that that I think right now has been halted by executive order, and so those dollars are not coming in. So they're, you know, we're committed at some way, shape, or form to be able to do this. We have to for the good and safety of the people we serve as well as our staff. So we're going to find a way, but obviously to not fund this is problematic.
Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. In light of that, I think we should hang on to it then till we get that fiscal note.
Representative Bingen.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Commissioner Schnell, for those comments. I do believe that there are also $20.1 million in new grants from the Minnesota Department of Human Services that will expand services, and those can be requested through the department, so just wanted to also include that.
Closing remarks, Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you guys for the discussion, and I appreciate all your support, and look forward to getting this done.
With that, House File 1399 is laid over. Vice Chair Witte, you can remain at the testifier table since the next bill is also yours. Since you are a member of the committee, would you like to move House File 1410 before the committee with a recommendation? It is re-referred to the General Register.
You asked me a question.
Would you like to refer this to the General Register?
That is my hope.
Vice Chair Witte, please begin your testimony.
So House File number 1410 is states the provision of a Peace Officer Discipline Procedure Act. It applies to the local correction facilities and local detention facilities. And it's just changing the language so it would apply to the Officer Bill of Rights.
I see you have some testifiers with you. Would you testifiers begin by stating their name for the record and begin?
Good afternoon, Chair Novotny and committee members. My name is Renee Zachman. I'm a staff attorney with Law Enforcement Labor Services, Minnesota's largest labor union representing public safety professionals. For more than 10 years, I've had the pleasure of representing correctional officers and licensed peace officers in union matters within the workplace. And I'm here today to testify in support of House File number 1410. This bill will include Minnesota's county and municipal correctional officers within the Peace Officer Discipline Procedures Act, thereby extending the Peace Officer Bill of Rights to those correctional officers so that they can enjoy the same due process and protection in workplace investigations as their licensed counterparts. Currently, correctional officers enjoy fewer rights when facing allegations of misconduct in the workplace. For example, they are not entitled to a summary of the allegations made against them prior to being questioned. The employer is not required to record their statement when they are questioned, and they're not entitled to know who will appear as a witness against them prior to the commencement of a disciplinary hearing. Allowing correctional officers to enjoy these rights will help to ensure adequate due process for our public safety professionals who are in the correctional line of work. Just as is the case for Minnesota's peace officers, the elements of due process within the Police Officer Discipline Procedures Act are critical to ensure fair outcomes when officers face allegations of misconduct within the workplace. Further, the bill will more clearly define what constitutes a formal statement within the meaning of the Act in order to prevent employers from attempting to skirt the requirements of the statute. This is necessary because in my more than 10 years of experience representing public safety professionals, some employers do attempt to circumvent the requirements of the statute. And they'll do this by attempting to take informal statements from officers or calling them in for informal meetings or inquiries, even going so far as to make assurances to those officers that the meeting is not a big deal and something they don't need to worry about, even though the meeting or the interview may result in serious disciplinary action against the officer. And this is directly contrary to the intention of the statute. It deprives officers of due process. It can result in unfair, inaccurate, and often incomplete investigative conclusions that result in poor outcomes for the officer and, critically, the employer alike. Due process always lends itself to fairer outcomes in disciplinary investigations within the workplace. And fair outcomes in disciplinary investigations are better for employees. They're better for the employer, and they're better for the public. It's only fair that correctional officers, like their licensed peace officer counterparts, should enjoy these protections as well. Thank you.
Thank you. Next testifier appears to be Mr. Peters. Mr. Peters, state your full name and begin your testimony.
Chair, members of the committee, my name is Brian Peters. I'm the executive director of the Minnesota Police and Peace Officers Association. Our organization represents about 1,800 local correction officers, many in sheriff's department across the state. I thought it'd be appropriate to first start off by just saying thank you. I know that we are the last bill on the agenda today, and some days I don't know how you guys all do it. You have a tough job, you hear a lot of different things, but I just wanna say the work doesn't go unnoticed, and I appreciate the partnerships, the collaborations. We don't always necessarily agree on things, but I do enjoy the conversations, and I do want you to know I appreciate from my organization the work that you do. I try to make it as easy as possible. There's a spreadsheet within your packet that kind of demonstrates the difference between the Police Officers Discipline Procedures Act and the Correctional Officers Procedure Act. I know Attorney Zachman covered some of the things of the difference in the different acts, but you can see on the spreadsheet highlighted in yellow is what correctional officers, what they don't have when it comes to allegations, which can sometimes be very serious, whether it's a use of force case, whether it's a sexual assault allegation. And in a time where we're seeing recruiting and retention issues in correctional officers, we want to maintain a streamlined process across the state. There are many sheriff's departments that do it right, that follow what they need to follow. But unfortunately, there's other departments that sometimes like to sidestep things to make to make a process quicker. And we believe strongly that a correctional officer deserves the same rights as a police officer, being that in many instances the allegations against our members can be the same. I won't go over the entire document because I know Attorney Zachman covered some very important things, but you know, in any serious allegation, we believe strongly in a signed complaint, that when somebody is making an allegation that there is a complaint and a summary of the allegations, and sometimes that's not afforded to these correctional members that may get pulled into an office and informally started, you know, start being asked about allegations of misconduct. So I hope that that Excel spreadsheet really helps to differentiate, okay, what's the difference here? And for our 1,800 members that we represent, we just wanted to have a fair process. You know, I know when legislators are accused of different things, there's a formal process, and that's what we're asking for in this bill, just fairness, and making sure that administrations across the state of Minnesota are following guidelines and not sidestepping an investigation because they want to wrap it up as quickly as possible. And I know Attorney Zachman has represented many of the members and has seen a wide range of departments that do it well and other departments that don't do it so well. I'm happy to entertain questions. I know this is the last bill and it's getting late, but again, I appreciate your time. Thank you.
And members, looks like some of you found it, but it looks like this. It's in your packets. Are there any other testifiers? Members, questions? You don't have to, but Representative Corinne.
Thank you, Chair. Representative Witte, thank you again. Just looking over the comparisons, to me, there are a few things that stand out. And looking at, for example, taking a statement during the officer's work hours or compensated accordingly if not. Under the correctional officer discipline procedures, that doesn't exist. And that's just one of the things to me that pops out is like, just doesn't make sense. And I think quite a few of these don't make sense that they're consistent. And maybe, I don't know if that's because I'm just not familiar with the background of how it was developed or just because there's lack of consistency and we're addressing it now. But a lot of this makes a lot of sense to me. It doesn't really seem like there's a reason we shouldn't do it. I would just be curious if it has been any input or if anyone's here that could answer how AFSCME might feel about these changes.
Vice Chair Witte.
Thank you, Chair Novotny. When I was a Burnsville police officer, I was an internal affairs officer. And the one thing that I think the process for the integrity of it, depending on how way it shakes out, is very important. So having a list that you go through is so important, and having these common sense pieces. I have not talked to AFSCME, but when I did walk in, I did see a Teamster representative who represents some of the corrections officers, and he was supportive of it and asking me about expanding it. I'm just trying to get us back to this makes sense and let's kind of help out. I do think when you go to work in the process or the procedure, you don't know, and it depending, that will drive you out of the kind of the business a little bit. So when mistakes happen or there's issues that happen, this is a way to streamline it, and most of the sheriffs will be understanding it because they're doing it with the deputies.
Mr. Peters also looked like he wanted to weigh in.
You want to say something?
Yes, thank you, Chair Representative Curran. This is a bill that we've kind of been working on for the last 3 years. I know originally when we started this bill, we were including the State Department of Corrections, and we worked with Commissioner Snell to you know, kind of remove them for a variety of reasons, which made sense. And so we're back here again talking about this. I do appreciate your candor about, yes, some of this just makes complete sense, and that's why we're back, and that's why we're trying to, again, move this forward. We have worked with AFSCME in the past when we started 3 years ago talking about this, and they were in support. They knew the bill was here today, and I know that they also want the same protections for their members as well.
Representative Crow.
Thank you, Chair. And just not necessarily a question, just another comment overall that I agree with you, Representative Witte. I think having consistency It's not just to the benefit of an officer who maybe has an allegation against them, but for the integrity of the whole process, like you mentioned. And so I, you know, I'm sure that there is a process in place, there are checklists in place and all that. But it seems to me that there's a lot of details here that are gone through under one agreement and not under one act and not the other. And there's just a lot of details here that could be collected with the same integrity. So that's how I see it, and I appreciate it. Thank you.
Mr. Peters.
And thank you, Chair, Representative Curran. AFSCME does represent the state correctional officers. That was a big reason when we first got involved and started talking about this and working with them to make this bill specific to sheriffs and local correctional officers. But that's kind of a big difference, as AFSCME does represent the DOC corrections, which are not a part of this bill. It's the 1,800 roughly correctional officers in sheriff's departments.
Representative Curran, you're done. Lead Moeller.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Witte, and to your testifiers. I plan on supporting the bill.
Oh. I was hoping you'd give me time to organize. Vice Chair Witte, do you have any closing comments?
I just want to say thank you guys for the support. And on both bills in the conversation, and I appreciate that. Thank you.
And to Mr. Peters, thank you for your recognition of the hard work that we do here, and it is getting late into the end, and I have two more meetings to go to.
I also feel, Chair, that I don't know, I should be thanking Representative Witte for something since everybody else did today, so thank you.
Vice Chair Witte renews his motion that House File 1410 is recommended to be re-referred to the General Register. All in favor signify by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed say nay. Motion carries, and House File 1410 is re-referred to the General Register. Thank you, Vice Chair Witte, and to your testifiers. Our next committee meeting will be Wednesday, March 5th at 3 p.m. There being no further business for the committee today, this meeting is adjourned.